From WBUR in Boston, I'm Bill Littlefield, and this is NPR's Only a Game. Some of the big bucks are disappearing like long drives into the rough. Ahead on Only a Game, Tiger's latest sponsorship, Shanks, also celebrating the life of the first African-American All-American footballer and the tale of former NFL commissioner and Philadelphia Eagles team founder Burt Bell, who, on any given Sunday, might coin a phrase like, on any given Sunday. Also ahead, the country's best dreidel spinners convene in New York and go for the really big gelt.
This is about having fun. It's having the greatest Hanukkah party that you can have. We can't just get up there and fling the dreidel into the spinagogue. The best dreidel spinners here tonight put the time in and put the effort in to really come up with their own philosophy and their own spinning style.
Stay tuned. This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. This week, Tiger Woods was named Top Athlete of the Decade by the Associated Press and Top Golfer of the Year by the Golf Writers, and unhappily, those distinctions are somewhere in the middle of the list of reasons he remains in the news. It was revealed this week that an assistant to a doctor who has treated Woods had been arrested while allegedly bringing growth hormone to the doctor. It was also reported that Woods' wife had departed the premises of their recent contretemps with the intention of filing for divorce. On Thursday, PGA Commissioner Tim Fincham asserted that his sport would flourish in 2010, whether or not Tiger Woods was playing. Happily for Mr. Fincham, nobody interrupted his whistling past the graveyard to ask if he thought a meal of steak, potatoes, peas, and ice cream would be just as good without the steak and the ice cream. Here to discuss the impact of some of those stories on the present and future of pro golf is Larry Dorman, who has been following the Tiger Woods story for the New York Times. Mr. Dorman, welcome to Only a Game.
Good to be with you, Bill.
On Sunday, Accenture, a global consulting firm, ended its sponsorship deal with Tiger Woods. He had appeared in 83% of that company's ads over the past 6 years. This week, company employees were instructed to tear down all posters featuring Woods and turn them in. Were you surprised by these swift and decisive measures?
Well, actually, I was not surprised. Once a company makes a decision like that, there usually is no delay at all. So it really wasn't very surprising to me, and I think what they did was best for them.
It's kind of Orwellian, though, isn't it?
In a sense, I suppose it is. But again, when a company has advertisements, it doesn't matter how they're rendered obsolete. Once they're obsolete, they disappear from sight.
I understand that some of that stuff has turned up on eBay, so there may be some firings at Accenture, you know, when that caddy bib goes for $175.
Could be. I guess it depends on how traceable it is.
Gillette's strategy, at least so far, has been merely to limit Tiger Woods' role in their marketing. How has that worked out exactly?
Well, I think that what they did was coincide it with Tiger's announcement that he was going to take an indefinite break from competition, and their thinking there is that while Tiger is away, it doesn't make much sense to have him in one of their campaigns. And that's the way it's being presented, and I think it's probably close, although they could just be reevaluating and are using the opportunity to inch away. It all depends on, I think, whether or not there are any more revelations that would damage his relationship with a company like Gillette.
Nike chairman Phil Knight said last week that when Tiger Woods' career is over, quote, you'll look back on these indiscretions as a minor blip. Do you agree with that?
Well, I think he has it right for the time frame in which he answered the question, which was before a number of these revelations, the most recent ones, came about. And I think that unless there are some other revelations having to do with something other than the just the personal matters that Tiger was involved in, I think then Nike might reconsider that. But I think if everything stands the way it does now, they believe that Tiger will come back and will be as good a player as he has been in the past and will be their type of athlete. They have built all of their golf marketing in one way, shape, or form around Tiger, and he touches every aspect of it, and rightly so.
Is there a standard clause in athlete sponsor contracts that includes language stipulating that the athlete has to uphold a certain standard of behavior, and if he doesn't, all bets are off and he doesn't get the rest of his money?
Well, based on my experience in the golf industry with 10 years at Callaway as head of PR, I can tell you that every athlete that was signed by Callaway has that clause, mm-hmm. and I believe that every athlete signed by any corporation has that clause, because once you put your brand in the hands of an outside person or an endorser, you have to be able to protect yourself quickly from anything that person might do that would reflect badly on your on either your products or your company. So I would suspect that every company has some sort of what you just described, as which is commonly referred to as a morals clause.
In October, Forbes magazine declared that Tiger Woods had become the first billionaire sportsman. He's obviously very wealthy. How much do his recent losses amount to in terms of dollars, do you think? And what sort of dent does this all put in his wallet?
I would say it doesn't put a significant dent in the overall Tiger wallet. What it does do is it casts a pall over the possibility for future earnings. Again, that will depend on the type of company that decides it wants to align itself with Tiger, who, again, he's the most recognizable athlete on the stage today. He is the most accomplished golfer at this stage in his career of any who have ever played the game. So companies that are interested in aligning themselves for strategic reasons that perhaps don't involve family type of connections and an iconic, squeaky clean athlete wouldn't hesitate, I don't think.
Tiger Woods announced last week that he would take an indefinite break from competitions. Anybody's guess how long that break will be. But when he was away from the tour last year with an injury and then surgery, TV ratings dropped 50%. Are we going to see a similar effect this year?
It's obviously going to have an effect. You can't lose your number one player, your biggest draw, and expect it not to. But it's a difficult thing to predict, because there's never actually been any situation in golf like this. I would say that the numbers will be off the charts when he comes back for the first event. I don't think there's any doubt about that. Now, whether that can be sustained will be determined by just how Tiger is perceived during that event. How does he come across to people? How does he play? And have they forgiven him?
Tiger Woods is certainly not the only celebrity athlete to go from very high to very low in the public perception. But is this the worst fall from respectability and perhaps from profitability that we've ever seen?
Well, I think you have to say yes to that, because never has there been an athlete who achieved the heights that Tiger did. Tiger was at the very highest level an athlete can reach, and that was because he wasn't just a great performer. He wasn't just a celebrity. He was a hero, and he was a hero because he had a reputation for being a squeaky clean paragon of conduct and virtue, with his foundation and the amount of time and money that he spent on kids and the family, at least ostensibly from the outside, it was a model family. So going from that to where he is now, I would have to say the fall has been the most precipitous.
Reporter Larry Dorman has been following the story of Tiger Woods and his dwindling endorsements for the New York Times. Larry, thank you very much for joining me.
It was a pleasure, Bill. Thank you.
Last week in New York City, the College Football Hall of Fame inducted its class of 2009. William Henry Lewis was among the 18 men honored. To describe his induction as belated would be an understatement. Lewis played his football at Amherst and Harvard in the early 1890s, and at those two schools, according to Evan Albright, who has written extensively about Lewis, he began accumulating a long list of achievements and distinctions.
The first black All-American football player, for heaven's sake. The first African-American to captain a predominantly white team. That's Harvard. He also captained the Amherst squad as well when he was there. He wrote one of the first books on football, a primer of college football. He was one of the first African-American coaches for Harvard and was the first paid coach that Harvard ever had for its football program.
Under the eligibility rules of that time, William Lewis could play for Harvard while he was attending the law school there. After his playing and coaching days were over, Lewis moved on to achieve various other distinctions. President Theodore Roosevelt appointed him assistant U.S. attorney for Boston. A few years later, President Taft made Lewis an assistant attorney general, which, according to Evan Albright, continued Lewis's list of firsts.
It was at the time the highest federal office ever achieved by an African American, and in fact, it was the highest office ever achieved by an African American for more than 40 years. I think it wasn't until the Eisenhower administration that someone received a higher post in a presidential administration. It was very controversial.
Weirdly, well over 100 years after William Henry Lewis helped Harvard win 22 games while losing just two, the matter of African-American coaches at the top level of college football can still seem controversial. Richard Lapchick, the director of the DeVos Sport Business Management Program at the University of Central Florida, has written extensively about matters of race and sport.
College football coaching has been the most problematic of all the positions. I co-authored the autobiography of Eddie Robinson with Coach Robinson, and when I met him in 1997 for the first time, one of the things we discussed that night was that there were only 8 African-American head coaches in Division 1A, now called FBS, and when I delivered part of his eulogy 10 years later at Grambling State, I had to mention that in that 10 years, the numbers had gotten worse. There were only going to be 5 African-American head coaches that next year.
On the day we spoke, that number was up to 13. Perhaps the improvement will endure. But Richard Lapchick hopes current writers and historians will continue to tell and celebrate the stories of African-Americans who achieved firsts. A couple of years ago, he wrote a book about African-American athletes who had broken barriers as pro or college players. The response at the schools where the athletes had played surprised him.
The Ivy League schools, Big Ten, Big 12, SEC, and ACC, and 70% of the schools had no idea who their first African-American student athlete was. And they all went back and found it and began celebrating them on their campuses as a result of, you know, figuring out this was probably a pretty good idea.
The time for celebrating or re-celebrating the achievements and distinctions of William Henry Lewis came this month at the induction ceremonies of the National Football Foundation College Hall of Fame. Evan Albright is among those applauding that development.
I thought it was a wonderful thing that they did, that they went back and found Lewis. I mean, he was the most famous African-American at one point in the United States. It's not an exaggeration to say that, particularly when he was appointed Assistant Attorney General of the United States. And it is an amazing life.
If that amazing life has become at least a little less obscure thanks to the efforts of the College Football Hall of Fame, well then, well done.
Fight, Pitsy, Harvard, fight, fight, fight. Demonstrate to them our skill. Albeit they possess the might, nonetheless we have the will. How we shall celebrate our victory, we shall invite the whole team up for tea.
Come on up, boys.
It's 19 minutes past the hour. In an apparent attempt to inject some extra excitement into his football viewing, New Orleans Saints fan Wayne A. Spring told his friends that if the Saints beat Washington on Sunday, they could shoot his TV. After New Orleans won the game in overtime, about a dozen Saints fans showed up at Spring's home in Albany, Louisiana, supplied with guns and beer. After the 60-inch high-def flat-screen TV had disintegrated in the proverbial hail of bullets, Spring said of his neighbors, "I guess they're all right, but I ain't seen them lately." Spring also said he wouldn't be betting against the undefeated Saints again. "I'll be watching the game this weekend on a 13-inch black and white set," he said. "I've learned my lesson." I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, long ago in a galaxy far, far away, the NFL did not rule the sports universe. Really, it's true. But first, the NBA is past the point of early season jitters, and every division has at least one, if not two, teams off to extremely fast starts. Joining me now to sort out who will continue to contend and who will dribble away into obscurity is Kevin Hench of FoxSports.com. Kevin, welcome back to Only a Game.
Great to be here, Bill.
Denver had a surprising playoff run last season, reaching the Western Conference Finals after acquiring Chauncey Billups from Detroit. Now the Nuggets are on top of their division. Does Denver have enough talent to improve on last year's success?
You mean, can they take the Lakers one more game deep in the playoffs before losing?
Success is always relative, isn't it?
No. I mean, I think, you know, it's funny living in Los Angeles. The Lakers are so dominant now that the local press has started propping up the other teams. It's like the Lakers are going to treat the Western Conference like the Washington Generals, essentially. Yeah. There's nobody can touch that team, although we do need teams like the Nuggets and the Mavericks and the Suns, these kind of semi-pretenders, to keep it interesting. But no, I don't think the Nuggets, despite their strong start, are a legitimate threat to the defending champion Lakers.
The Dallas Mavericks, of course, have been good for a long time, but they never have won a title. They're out in front in the Southwest Division. Is it going to be another year of false hope for Dirk Nowitzki and company?
I don't think so, because I think there have been so many false hopes that people won't even get false hope for this season of false hope. If that tracks.
I'm going to have to go back and parse that out. I liked listening to it, but I have no idea what you
just said.
One of
the great regular season teams of all time. They're not going to scare anybody in the playoffs.
The Phoenix Suns, of course, still have Steve Nash, but Shaquille O'Neal has departed the premises. Are the Suns better without the big Aristotle?
They certainly seem to be, and Shaquille O'Neal, as his decline phase is reaching the end, he seems to have, it used to be, you know, he left the Magic, went to the Lakers, make the Lakers champions, and then he went to the Heat, made the Heat champions, but his last couple of stops, he does seem to have diminished the team to which he has arrived. And I think the Suns have done some addition by subtraction by getting rid of that 350 pounds and going back to their up-tempo style. And Steve Nash is having yet another incredible season. That guy is unbelievable.
Shaquille O'Neal's new team, the Cavaliers, are off to another strong start. We're about a third of the way through the season. Give us your first report card on the LeBron/Shaquille experiment in Cleveland.
Well, I feel like the expectation for LeBron was, oh good, the diesel is here, I won't have to work quite as hard every night to produce these victories, and I don't think that has been the case. Shaq has not provided that kind of relief with easy low post buckets. You know, LeBron is still working very hard, 38, 40, 42 minutes a night to pull off these victories. And I think we're going to see the same thing that we saw last year, which is come crunch time in the playoffs, LeBron has logged so many minutes that mid-range shooting percentage drops and the Cavaliers fall short again.
Kevin, speaking of the Lakers, as I've tried not to do too much, forward Ron Artest knows a thing or two about public relations problems, and this week he had some advice for Tiger Woods about how to handle a scandal. Artest decided the best way to share that advice was in an open letter, so I've read it, and I'm sure you have as well. Do you think Tiger will respond with an open thank you note?
Doubtful. Everyone feels obliged to weigh in on Tiger Woods, and I have to tell you, Bill, I'm doing a podcast with John Sally, four-time NBA champion John Sally, and it's called Spider and the Henchman, and podcasts tend to lead toward the profane, and we've tried to keep it clean, but I blame Tiger Woods for how profane our podcast has already gotten. In merely reporting this story, it gets a little prurient, as they used to say on the Supreme Court.
Oh, dear. Oh, dear. Well, for the record, anybody listening to the Only a Game podcast can be reassured that it is safe for children of all ages.
That's right. Three Tiger references maximum.
Allen Iverson was reunited with his original team, the Sixers, after a brief layover in Memphis earlier this season. Iverson's homecoming was a feel-good move, certainly, but the Sixers must be feeling pretty bad about their play so far, don't you think?
You know it's bad when the Nets are nipping at your heels. The Nets are closing on the Sixers. You know, it's Iverson is such a unique player and has been such a unique player, but his particular skill set is not one that's going to age well. You know, it's about speed, quickness, explosiveness.
Iverson doesn't have that burst. He's breaking down, and it really is sort of one of the sadder things to see this guy being reduced to sort of a short jump shooter. And the Sixers, obviously, in complete disarray. But they're going to go head-to-head with the Nets a few times down the stretch, and they would love nothing more, I'm sure, than to erase the 76ers' names from the record book for the all-time season of futility, 9-73 in 1972-73. That could really be epic, the Sixers playing to pin the Nets with an 8-74 season. And I think the Nets could make a run at that record. That's how bad they are.
Boston added Rasheed Wallace during the offseason. Kevin Garnett has recovered from his knee injury. The Celtics were the first team to 20 wins in the Eastern Conference. They face Orlando on Christmas Day in a rematch of last year's conference finals. Are the Celtics the team to beat in the East?
It's weird. The Celtics never lose and yet don't inspire that much confidence that they're for real. I don't know how this is possible. The Celtics are obviously going to win a lot of games between 62 and 66, and they probably will be the number one seed in the Eastern Conference. But Garnett, Pierce, Allen, a lot of mileage on those treads, and I just don't see them being able to beat the younger teams, the Hawks, Magic, Cavs, in a seven-game series.
All right, Kevin, you are not some fresh-faced, starry-eyed newcomer to the Only a Game drill, so let's hear your picks for the NBA Finals.
I like the Lakers to win the Western Conference.
Astonishing. I don't know how you go so far out on that particular limb.
I'm out on a limb. and although I'm going to contradict myself 30 seconds apart, I will say that the Celtics will beat the Magic in seven games to win the Eastern Conference Finals, and then the Lakers will prevail, Kobe Bryant getting his second consecutive title over the Big Three.
Kevin Hench covers the NBA for FoxSports.com, and his new podcast with John Sally, Spider and the Henchman, is available on iTunes and on AdamCarolla.com. Kevin, thanks very much for speaking with me.
Thank you, Bill.
A lot of the guys who were around when pro football teams paid their best players a couple hundred dollars a game and everybody on the team had a day job would tell you that if it hadn't been for Burt Bell, maybe there would never have been a National Football League. Bell, who founded and co-owned the Philadelphia Eagles in 1933 and became the league's commissioner 13 years later, struggled to build pro football long before it partnered up with television to become a national obsession. Robert Lyons has written a biography of Burt Bell titled On Any Given Sunday, and he joins me now from WRTI in Philadelphia to discuss same. Welcome to Only a Game.
Thank you, Bill.
Burt Bell is credited with coming up with the phrase, on any given Sunday, any team can beat any other team. But during most of the days when Bell owned the Eagles, his team couldn't beat anybody, could it?
That's correct. Burt was the founder and the first owner of the Eagles. And he was also the first coach of the Eagles, and he was a terrible coach. And he finally realized a few years later when he became part owner of the Pittsburgh Steelers with Art Rooney. Art told him, Burt, we have to get a new coach. You have to quit. And he did. And so he was a much better owner and commissioner than he was football coach.
Beyond the on any given Sunday phrase, the very idea of football on Sunday was a big issue for a while, wasn't it?
Well, that's correct. As a matter of fact, one of Burt's biggest thrills was when he finally convinced the city council in Philadelphia to allow pro football on Sunday afternoon. And one of his proudest possessions was the certificate of permission, which gave him the right to play the first football game at Scheib Park, the old baseball stadium in Philadelphia.
It's such an institution now. I mean, for so many people, Sunday means NFL games that it's hard to believe that the NFL couldn't play on Sunday when they started out.
It's amazing. And, you know, the league, everything was so primitive back in those days. And one of Burt's biggest accomplishments that he talked about when he was the club owner, in fact, it was the year before he became commissioner, he convinced the other owners to provide chalk and blackboards for the visiting teams. That's how the basic and fundamental and primitive the league was.
Is it fair to say that the football league in which Burt Bell's Eagles played in the mid and late 30s was for the most part ignored?
Absolutely. It was really until about 1957 or 58 when the Eagles finally were able to move into Franklin Field and play their home games at the stadium of the University of Pennsylvania, which was a story in itself because Penn for years in college football had dominated the sporting scene. And Penn was drawing 80,000 fans at the time, believe it or not. And pro football and the Eagles in particular in Philadelphia were lucky if they got 20,000 fans. But when they moved into Franklin Field, I remember Tom Brookshire telling me that we moved uptown. We became big time. Mm-hmm. And that was the truth.
Another significant difference between pro football when Bell owned the Eagles and the current NFL is that none of the current players would be likely to take up residence in the owner's house. But it seems as if Burt Bell's children learned to take for granted that some of Dad's large and hungry employees would be sleeping on the floor all season.
That's right. They couldn't afford to pay them that much. So one of the perks, Burt said, okay, well, come live at my house. And he used to have practices out on his front lawn. And this was in the uppity main line of Philadelphia where the society people, as Upton told me, they didn't mind you having horses in your backyard, but they didn't want football players.
One particular story may serve to characterize the financial conditions under which Burt Bell was operating back in the 30s. Tell us about what one of his players, a guy named Dave Smuckler, told Bell after a game in which Smuckler was unhappy with his own performance.
Well, Dave came into the office and said to Burt, "Burt, I was so terrible today. I don't want you to pay me for my performance today." And, of course, they were then being paid on game-to-game contracts. It wasn't until Burt became commissioner that he came up with the first annual contract for players. But Dave was going to give his money back.
And not paying Dave Smuckler on that particular week might mean that they made the payroll with the rest of the guys, right? I mean, it was that close sometimes.
It was very close. As a matter of fact, a couple of years later, Alexis Thompson won the NFL championship in 1948. And could not meet his payroll. Mm. And, of course, by this time, Burt was commissioner, and the league had to bail the Eagles out. So, I mean, 12 years after Burt became commissioner, they were still struggling financially.
One of the innovations Bell brought to the National Football League was sudden death overtime. And my impression from reading the biography is that the first time sudden death overtime was necessary, the players had no idea what was going on. Have I got that right?
That is correct. I had a number of players told me that, including Frank Gifford and Raymond Burry, and there was a lot of confusion at the end of regulation. And the referee came over and said, "Well, gentlemen, we're playing 15 minutes overtime." And they said, "What?" And they all thought they were going to be going home with their splitting their half shares or whatever. Burt was just absolutely thrilled, and this was the highlight of his career because he had lobbied for sudden death overtime for a number of years. The inspiration for sudden death overtime came from his buddies that he used to hang out with outside a drugstore in Narberth, Pennsylvania. And they said to him, "Burt, we don't want ties. Ties are like kissing your sister and all that stuff." And Burt went home and he thought, "You know what? They're right."
I'm speaking with Robert Lyons, the author of On Any Given Sunday, A Life of Burt Bell, and you're listening to Only a Game. How else did Commissioner Burt Bell put his personal stamp on pro football?
Well, the biggest single thing that he did, he talked the owners into agreeing to this newfangled idea called a player draft. Burt had been burned by a player that he tried to sign from Minneapolis, and the player played him along and refused to sign and was obviously tickering for a better contract from another team. And Burt was convinced after that that there's no way. I mean, the rich teams like the Giants and the Bears, they're going to dominate pro football, and the poorer teams are going to suffer, and the league will never survive if this is the case. It took a lot of arm twisting, a lot of negotiating. Finally, he convinced George Halas. And this was amazing because Burt had only been an owner a couple of years. The player draft became, I quoted an author by the name of Mark Yost, and he said, Bell's idea for the draft, in fact, has turned out to be the single greatest contributor to the NFL's prosperity over the past 84 years. And I think that sums it up pretty well.
Burt Bell died at Franklin Field in Philadelphia in 1959 while he was watching a football game between the Eagles and the Steelers. Shortly thereafter, Westbrook Pegler, the widely read columnist, wrote, quote, "Nobody typified America more than Burt Bell." That's an assertion that goes well beyond football, obviously. What do you suppose Pegler meant by it?
Well, two things happened. Of course, the one thing was sudden death overtime that we talked about. And the other thing was the advent of television. Upton and Burt Jr. told me that Burt used to be insistent to his PR man by the name of Joe Labrum. Joe, I want a NFL player on the Ed Sullivan show every Sunday night. And Ed Sullivan would point to him and say hello to the great running back from the New York Giants, Frank Gifford. And that would be it. But Burt wanted to see that because that gave his league really some credibility. And, of course, TV was really in its infancy back in those days.
Robert S. Lyons is the author of On Any Given Sunday, A Life of Burt Bell, published by Temple University Press. He joined me from WRTI in Philadelphia. Bob, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Thank you, Bill.
It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced. Account Temps, a global provider specializing in temporary staffing of accounting and finance professionals, locations worldwide. Details at accounttemps.com. And AVFX, Boston-based and serving the nation with audiovisual staging tools at corporate meetings, trade shows, and live events. Location information at avfx.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
What you win if you finish first in the snooker championship of the United Kingdom is you win pies. More specifically, you get your weight in pies. So Ding Junhui, who hails from China but resides in Sheffield and weighs 69 kilograms, found himself with 276 meat pies after he had emerged victorious among snooker players. In the spirit of the season, Mr. Junhui did not eat all the pies. He didn't eat any of them. He gave them to a charity in his adopted town that helps the homeless at Christmas. "I've lived in Sheffield for the past few years, and I love the city," he said. "I hope there are enough pies to stop people going hungry." I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, competitive dreidel spinning, sports. But first, I'm joined by Charlie Fierce for our look at the week's news. Hello, Charlie.
Hey, Bill.
On Wednesday, the AP named Tiger Woods their Athlete of the Decade, and on Thursday, he was named Male Player of the Year by the Golf Writers Association of America. Great week for Tiger, huh?
Well, let's face facts. If we're being coolly objective about this, just for stamina alone, he's the top athlete of the decade. And who can argue that Tiger Woods is not the Male Player of the Year?
Yeah,
I ask you this.
It's too bad that that award was titled as it was.
It's really bad when you've screwed up your life to the point where every award you win is a punchline.
Elsewhere on the Tiger Watch, it was revealed this week that back in September, the assistant to a Canadian doctor, Anthony Galea, who has treated Tiger Woods and other elite athletes, was found to be in possession of a growth hormone and various other drugs she was allegedly taking to Dr. Galea. Nice timing there.
Yeah, good timing. Unfortunately, this story exists only because you can put the name Tiger Woods and the phrase performance-enhancing drugs in the same sentence and get away with it with a massive amount of innuendo. There's no connection to Tiger Woods here at all. If he had the platelet therapy that this doctor apparently specializes in, it's not illegal. It's perfectly legal. To me, of all the Tiger stories of the last 2 weeks, this is the cheapest shot.
The Indianapolis Colts are 14-0 after Thursday's come-from-behind win over the Jacksonville Jaguars. The 13-0 New Orleans Saints will try to draw even with Indy's record tonight when they play Dallas. Wouldn't it be cool to have the first Super Bowl ever where two undefeated teams faced each other?
It would be cool for about the first 2 days after the matchup was finalized, at which point you would be so sick of it that you would just want the whole thing to go away. But yes, not only would it be cool to have that in theory, these are two very fun teams to watch, as you saw on Thursday night when the Colts probably should have lost to Jacksonville and did not.
The College Bowl season is at our throats once again. It begins today and features 34, count them, 34 games in all. I have a new favorite, Charlie, the St. Petersburg presented by Beef O'Brady's Bowl, and you can take that in any direction you like.
If you asked me for a prediction on the Beef O'Brady's Bowl, and I gave you a school that was not playing in it, would you be able to tell me I was wrong?
No.
Okay, fine. So Notre Dame is going to win the Beef O'Brady's Bowl because it's an Irish name.
Bowl games and snacks have long been synonymous, and now allegations that Tostitos Fiesta Bowl employees were pressured to donate money to political candidates through bonus payments has strengthened that bond, wouldn't you say?
This is what we call, those of us who have watched the Massachusetts legislature in action over these many years, this is what we call a kickback scandal, and somebody's going to jail behind this.
In pro basketball news, at least two NBA coaches, Stan Van Gundy and Larry Brown, are asserting that the league's superstars are granted preferential treatment by referees. I can't say that without laughing. Is this because Coach Van Gundy and Coach Brown just have insufficient superstars on their rosters?
No, and me with my unicorn tied up to the meter outside the studio. You know, what's interesting is Larry Brown told the Charlotte Observer, you know, he's talking about this, and he said, some people can do that and some can't, and that's wrong. You can't ref that way. Well, you pretty plainly can ref that way since they've been refing that way for about 30 years now. Bill Russell complained that Oscar Robertson got an extra step, and that was a long time ago.
Oh, wait a minute. We just got an email from Michael Jordan that says, no, this is ridiculous. Never happened. This week, Kentucky head basketball coach John Calipari of the Memphis, Amherst, and Exit 16W Calipari's came under withering criticism from a former coach. Who was that?
We like to call John the former head coach in two locations of the University of Vacated, given the fact that he had two teams that made the Final Four, neither of which exist in the official records anymore. Bob Knight has decided to do one of those things that makes me like Bob Knight for 83 consecutive seconds. He said that we've gotten into a situation where integrity is really lacking. You've got a coach of Kentucky who put two schools on probation, and he's still coaching. I really don't understand that. Well, in fact, you do understand that, Bob. It's all about the do-re-mi, and the people of Kentucky don't care.
A court commissioner this week set a May date for the trial that will determine whether Jamie McCourt, who's divorcing her husband, will retain an ownership stake in the Los Angeles Dodgers. This suggests to me that the Dodgers will open the 2010 season without knowing who owns the team. Any problem there?
I think, you know, all owners always say, you know, hey, we finished third with them, we can finish third without them. Well, you know what? The Dodgers keep losing in the playoffs with an owner. Maybe they should try it without. I am curious, though, which one of the McCourts was it that traded Juan Pierre this week?
We'll have to wait to see how it turns out.
Or is he really traded?
One of them will claim.
I mean, can the judge void the trade because Jamie wasn't consulted?
Since approximately forever, Charlie, we've been hearing that the Toronto Blue Jays wanted to trade Roy Halladay. They've finally done it. He'll be pitching for the Phillies next season. Good fit?
I think so. He will be utterly dominant in the National League. He will probably win 20 games. The National League's made to order for Roy Halladay.
If FC Barcelona beats Estudiantes of Argentina in the Club World Cup final later today, Barca will have won an unprecedented six major trophies in a single calendar year. I know your interest in soccer is minimal, so let's not make this a soccer question. Let me just ask you this. How can any team that I support be so successful?
I have no idea, and we have made it to the middle of this question without my picking up a tack hammer and driving a tenpenny nail into my ear. But I would point out that Bartha has already won the Champions League, the Spanish League, Copa del Rey, the Spanish Super Cup, and the European Super Cup trophies in this past calendar year. Do you get the feeling there's one too many soccer competitions in this world? I think Barcelona may well have finished fourth in last year's Miss Universe pageant.
And finally, Charlie Richard Branson owns the F1 racing team Virgin Racing. Tony Fernandez owns Lotus F1. Both guys also own airlines. And this has apparently set up a very intriguing wager. Would you care to explain it?
Fernandez said that if his new team didn't finish ahead of Branson's Virgin Racing team, quote, I will retire and kill myself. Branson said, hey, he's got an airline, I've got an airline. If we beat him, he can work on our airline as a stewardess, and that Branson would do the same if Virgin finished behind Lotus. I think this is really neat when billionaires get out and play, but I don't want to fly on either one of those airplanes. Can you imagine falling asleep on the flight to London and waking up with Richard Branson in a dress?
Charlie Pierce writes for the Boston Sunday Globe magazine, and of course he joins me each week at this time on Only a Game as well. Thank you very much,
Thank
Charlie.
You, Bill. Merry Christmas to you. Merry Christmas to everybody out there who listens to us every week.
Keith O'Brien's story about how the University of Cincinnati football team partnered with Mitch Stone, the 12-year-old boy who underwent treatment for brain cancer, touched lots of listeners. DJ Bybee, who hears Only a Game on WAMC in Albany, New York, emailed to say, I have had more than one occasion to find myself crying in the car listening to NPR. I never expected that to happen while listening to Only a Game early Saturday morning on my way to work. Your story about Mitch Stone being adopted by the University of Cincinnati football team floored me. This is a story of everything that is right in the world. Thank you for bringing it to me. Ian O'Neill, who hears the program on WUNC in North Carolina, was similarly moved. It is very rare to hear these types of stories of athletes on any level giving back to their communities or individuals like this. I have no real rooting interest in the Bearcats, but I will cheer them on for the love the team shows Mitch every day. Kevin Corbett, who knows a lot more Japanese than I do, wrote to comment on my conversation last week with Charlie Pierce. I'd mentioned that the Bengals receiver, formerly known as Chad Ochocinco, had changed his name to Chad Achigo, which, I said, means Chad 85 in Japanese. No, Mr. Corbett wrote, 85 in Japanese would be Achijugo, which means that Chad made the same mistake in Japanese that he'd made in Spanish. Gina Smith, who listens to Only a Game on KXCV in Maryville, Missouri, emailed to say thanks for the story on the football team at Northwest Missouri State, which, remarkably, Only a Game did not jinx with our mention of how often that team had been to the Division II championship game only to come up short. Northwest Missouri State beat Grand Valley State 30-23 on Saturday. We are delighted that our story had no apparent effect on the outcome of that game. And finally, Brian Harkins, a WBUR listener, emailed this week to express his dismay at some of the dismay other listeners had expressed. I hope the negative reaction to some recent stories you've aired won't discourage you from doing a feature on the Wet T-Shirt Bull Racing League I'm forming, he wrote. Should I put the T-shirts on the bulls or the riders? You can send your questions and comments to us via the website, onlyagame.org. You can also leave a comment on the listener line by calling 617-353-1860, or you can find us on Facebook and Twitter, username onlyagameradio. Hanukkah ends at sundown today. The candles will grow dim, the uneaten gelt will disappear, but the memories of the festivities will endure. Memories like the six-hour competitive dreidel spin fest Only a Game's John Kalish attended last weekend in a Brooklyn club.
On the night of the dreidel spinning contest, I rode my bicycle through the Williamsburg section of Brooklyn en route to a music venue called the Knitting Factory. The Jewish Sabbath had ended, and there were Hasidic Jews dressed in black hurrying about the cold city streets. As I passed through the neighborhood and entered what is referred to as the hipster section of Williamsburg, the synagogues and kosher food stores gave way to bars and boutiques. Inside the Knitting Factory, a crowd of people mostly in their 20s and 30s are having drinks and munching on Hanukkah fare like jelly donuts and chocolate coins. A DJ plays tunes from a laptop, and dreidel spinners wear baseball caps with felt menorahs on them. The commissioner of so-called Major League Dreidel is Eric Pavone, who owns an area bar.
Welcome to the 2009 Major League Dreidel Tournament!
Pavone sells a small plastic dreidel spinning board shaped like a Jewish star for $40. In the Spinagogue's hexagonal center, the dreidel is spun. There are two inserts that make the hexagon smaller and more difficult for spinning. When the dreidel drifts into the wall of the hexagon, the spin usually comes to an abrupt end. This competition is all about a player's TOS, or time of spin.
When the dreidel exits your fingertips, that's the release. The dreidel then goes into the orbit, okay, the most crucial part and movement of a spin. The orbit gives birth to the wobbles. The final and fourth movement of a dreidel spin is the finish, when the dreidel comes to a complete rest on its side.
The spinagogues are set up on high tables and competitors stand around them. Competitors dub themselves Spindiana Jones, Maccababe, Dreidel Attraction, and Lisa Spinson. Even the refs have goofy names. One declared he was Andreidel the Giant, and another who carried an artist's palette and paintbrush called himself Spinson Van Gogh. The refs time each competitive spin and play a role that is also part game show host and part color commentator.
9.47. Spin or no spin?
Competitors can go for a second spin, but if their time is worse than the first, then they're stuck with it. This proves fatal to last year's champion spinner. There are more than 100 competitors this year, but none of them gets terribly close to the world record of 17.88 seconds.
14.91.
Still, the crowd gets excited when spins surpass 15 seconds.
Creeping toward the wall a little bit. Starting to creep. Gotta hold it. Gotta hold it. Gotta be 12.65. 15.06.
One of the refs, Ted Carmel, explains what makes a good spin.
It's got to come off the fingers smooth and stay in the middle. I've seen a couple guys come off the wall early and go back into the middle tight. But as you get toward the end of the spin and the breakdown and the wobbles and the breakdown, you can't be near the wall because it can break down and wobble for a good 3 to 5 seconds. If it hits the wall, it kills you immediately in that part of the spin.
The dreidel commissioner, Eric Pavone, says competitive dreidel spinning is about both fun and work.
This is about having fun. It's having the greatest Hanukkah party that you can have. We can't just get up there and fling the dreidel into the spinagogue. The best dreidel spinners here tonight put the time in and put the effort in to really come up with their own philosophy and their own spinning style.
One group of spinners that fits that description is Team Smoot from Michigan. Team Smoot is named after Claude Henry Smoot, a character in one of Chevy Chase's Fletch movies. The team trains at a bar in Ypsilanti, Michigan, where they've also competed in rock, paper, scissors. Many of them wear their college graduation gowns and ski hats at the dreidel competition. Kurt and Schutz says hardly anyone on Team Smoot is Jewish, but they somehow managed to convince a Jewish friend in New York to provide lodging while the team is in town to spin.
I convinced him it was a mitzvah for him to house us during the dreidel competition, and he agreed. So,
how many of you is he housing?
Well, there's 16.
One member of Team Smoot, a knitter who goes by the name of Wool Spinner, makes it into the semifinals. Another female member of the team is Amy Probst, who met her teammates just 2 weeks before.
We really did work very hard to get here. I mean, there was a lot of practice, and the fact that they brought me along and they're putting me up and they don't really know me, it's just awesome that we're really here and doing it. My mom is a little nervous. She said, "Where did you meet these people again?" And I didn't want to tell her a bar, so I said, "Oh, in the neighborhood."
10-16. The final spinoff pits a first-time spinner known as Johnny Hayes against last year's defending champ, Virtual Dreidel, who just so happens to be the father of Major League Dreidel's commissioner. In the last minutes of the competition, Virtual Dreidel spins a disappointing 8.34, declares it a no spin, and then proceeds to let loose with a disastrous twirl of less than a full second.
Oh, man! Are you kidding me? Are you kidding me? For the first time in his spinning career, Virtual Dreidel melts down.
As the new Dreidel champ accepts his slick crystal trophy and gift certificate for a Judaica website, a heavy metal band launches into a celebratory song. That's the Gods of Fire, who released a CD of 8 tunes this year titled Chanukah Goes Metal. Here's my monosyllabic review. Oi. For Only a Game, I'm John Kalish in New York.
Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Doug Trabu. Our technical director is John Perotti. Our intern is Jeremy Bernfeld. We had help this week from Mario Valdez and from Joe Patti at WRTI in Philadelphia. Our senior producer is Gary Wallach. To subscribe to the Only a Game podcast, listen to archived shows and stories, learn more about our weekly music selections, or view our photo galleries, please visit our website, onlyagame.org. To share your opinions about stories you've heard on Only a Game and to get behind-the-scenes information about the show, you can visit our Facebook and Twitter pages, username Only a Game Radio. Our final word is from historian and author Evan Albright.
Dude, you're Bill Littlefield.
He's already told you who I am. Thanks for listening, dudes and dudettes, and I'll see you next week.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR in Boston. Mini, featuring the 37 miles per gallon Mini Cooper with go-kart handling. Learn more at miniusa.com/info. The George Lucas Educational Foundation, creator of Edutopia, your source for what works in public education. Learn more at edutopia.org. And the Wallace Foundation, a source of ideas for expanding learning opportunities beyond the school day at wallacefoundation.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.